From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, actor Jeff Bridges, the star of such films as Seabiscuit, The Big Lebowski, The Contender, and The Last Picture Show. His new movie is The Door in the Floor, based on the best-selling John Irving novel A Widow for 1 Year. Also, we'll hear some rare early studio recordings made of the late Ray Charles, circa 1953. And we'll listen back to an interview with sci-fi writer Isaac Asimov. The new movie, I, Robot, is loosely based on his short fiction. And film critic David Edelstein reviews the new documentary, Metallica, Some Kind of Monster. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Martha Stewart has been sentenced to 5 months in prison and fined $30,000 for lying to investigators. But a federal judge stayed her sentence pending appeals. Fred Mogul reports from member station WNYC.
Stewart also received 2 years of probation, with 5 months of that to be served as home confinement. Her former stockbroker, Peter Bakanovic, also received a sentence of 5 months in prison. Outside the courthouse, Stewart said she was deeply sorry, but also struck a calmly defiant note.
What was a small personal matter became over the last 2 years an almost fatal circus event of unprecedented proportions.
She urged fans to keep buying Martha Stewart Living and advertisers to keep purchasing ads. She thanked her supporters, many of whom chanted, "Save Martha." For NPR News, I'm Fred Mogul in New York.
11 more Filipino soldiers left Iraq today as their government tries to avert the threatened murder of a Filipino civilian who's been kidnapped by insurgents. The troops left Iraq by truck, crossing the border into Kuwait. The Philippines' foreign minister said 32 Filipino military personnel remain to be withdrawn from Iraq. She added that the head of the Philippines' humanitarian mission in Iraq will also leave the country. The Philippines originally planned to withdraw its troops by August 20th, but decided to pull them out early because of the kidnappers' threat. The United States and Australia said that the Philippines' decision sends the wrong message to terrorists. The Los Alamos Nuclear Weapons Lab is looking for two missing data storage devices containing classified material. Sources tell NPR the devices came from a division that works with high explosives. NPR's David Kestenbaum has more.
The division, called DX, studies the high explosives used in nuclear weapons. The explosives compress the nuclear material in the bomb's core, creating a chain reaction. A Los Alamos official would only say the data were stored on portable devices, like CDs or floppy disks. One source affiliated with the lab says the devices do not appear to contain actual bomb designs. The lab has put a temporary stop to all classified work. The order affects some 4,000 to 5,000 employees. Sources at Los Alamos say the lab's director is furious. In a staff meeting, they say he cursed, said people would be fired, and warned of a cowboy attitude. The lab has tens of thousands of classified data storage devices. Sandia National Lab says it also recently lost a floppy disk labeled classified. David Kestenbaum, NPR News, Washington.
Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials lost 23 points to close at 10,139 in moderate trading. The Dow was down 73 points for the week. The Nasdaq lost 29 points, or 1.5%, to close at 1883. This is NPR News. Emergency workers in southern India say that more than 80 children were killed today when fire swept through a thatch-roofed school. Police say more than 20 other children were injured. Police have arrested the school's principal, saying school officials and teachers may have been negligent. No teachers were killed in the blaze, but a district administrator said they probably helped to rescue about 700 children who got out safely. The nation's first female black sheriff is stepping down from her position in Atlanta. Fulton County Sheriff Jackie Barrett leaves her job amid criticism over jail overcrowding and investments she made with public money. Mike Savage reports from Georgia Public Broadcasting.
The leave of absence until the end of her term in December comes after high-profile complaints about jail overcrowding, inmates who escaped, and an investigation into more than $7 million of public money she spent on questionable investments. This week, a U.S. district judge appointed a former jail administrator of the U.S. Penitentiary in Atlanta to take over control of the jail from Barrett. The move follows a lawsuit claiming conditions at the jail are inhumane and unsafe. The jail was designed for about 1,400 inmates, but averages more than 3,000. An attorney for Barrett said the sheriff is stepping down because she has not been treated fairly and has been taking the blame for conditions in the jail that she cannot control. Barrett was elected the first black female sheriff in the nation in 1992. For NPR News, I'm Mike Savage in Atlanta.
Consumer prices posted a modest gain in June after rising sharply the month before. The Labor Department said consumer prices were up 0.3%, largely because of a boost in food and energy costs. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Fry Brothers Vineyards, makers of Redwood Creek, wines inspired by the adventurous spirit of California. Redwood Creek wines are available at fine wine retailers.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Our guest, Jeff Bridges, is famous for his work in front of the camera, in films such as The Last Picture Show, The Fabulous Baker Boys, The Fisher King, The Big Lebowski, and Seabiscuit. He's starring in a new film with Kim Basinger, The Door in the Floor, based on a novel by John Irving. Bridges plays a philandering children's book author whose family is torn by tragedy. Things get more complicated when they invite a young aspiring writer into their vacation home. Basinger plays Bridges' wife. Here they are making plans.
Look at this yard. Clear out some of these scraggly-looking flower beds. I want to put in a swimming pool.
Why?
Oh, for Ruth when she gets older. Something like the one we had in Providence. They loved it. And the lawn. That'd be more like an athletic field.
No.
Look at this picture.
Who is he?
It's Minty O'Hare's son. The boy's English teacher from Exeter. He wants a summer job. He wants to be a writer.
What would he do for you?
Well, it's mainly for the experience, I suppose. I mean, if he's thinking about becoming a writer, he should see how one works, see what it takes.
What would he actually do for you?
Jeff Bridges has also done work behind the camera, which is presented in his book, Pictures. When he's on the set of a movie, he takes pictures behind the scenes, then makes a book of these photos, which he presents to the people he's worked with after the film is wrapped. The foreword of the book Pictures is written by Peter Bogdanovich, who directed Bridges in The Last Picture Show and its sequel, Texasville. He writes that Bridges' photos convey the very essence of what making movies looks and feels like: haphazard, messy, profoundly private and lonely. Most of the photos are of actors, directors, and crew members. But one photo in the book is of Texan Rusty Lindemann. Bridges took the picture while he was making Texasville. Terry spoke to Bridges last fall and asked him to tell the story behind the picture.
The wardrobe designer was fired about a week before we started shooting, and my character had no costume whatsoever. We had nothing locked in. And the first day of shooting was one of those days that our small little scenes kind of scattered throughout the entire movie, so it's really going to, in that first day, I'm going to establish all of my wardrobe. And here I am in my trailer trying to figure out on that first day what I'm going to wear. And I hear a knock, and I say, "I'm coming," and I open the door, and standing there is a Western-looking fella. He's got a, you know, cowboy hat on and kind of work clothes, and the fella says, "Hi, my name's Rusty Lindemann. I own this ranch that you're shooting on. I just wanted to let you know that anything I can do to help you, you let me know." And I looked at him for a second, and I said, "Can I have your clothes?"
Yeah.
And he said, "Why, sure." And he proceeded to come in and take off his clothes. And because I was playing a wealthy oil man who was exactly, you know, a fella like Rusty. And he, you know, gave me his clothes. We switched clothes. I did the first shot in his clothes. And then at lunch, break, I went over to his house and went through his closet, and he gave me all of his clothes. So that was like, and there's a shot of actually of Rusty in the book, and that was like an angel sent from heaven.
So did you fit into his clothes?
Perfectly. It was just bizarre. You know, and I said, can I have those pens in your pocket and all those papers? And he says, oh, yeah, whatever I can do.
Now, there's a picture of the Coen brothers trying to figure out how to get your head stuffed in a toilet without breaking your teeth. And that was about what?
Well, that's a shot in the Big Lebowski where they, towards the beginning of the movie, where they these two hoodlums take my body and shove my head into a toilet. And we're trying to figure out how we're going to do this this scene without, you know, breaking my teeth in the porcelain. And so this is a shot of the guys trying to figure that out. How we're going to, stick my head in the toilet and reverse it, or, you know, reverse the film or something. You know, how are we going to give the illusion that this is all happening at full speed?
How did you do it?
We just did it, finally, I think. We just, worked it out. A lot of those things are kind of like, choreographing a dance or something, and you work with the other actors, and the illusion is that they're taking me, but in fact, I'm taking them, and they're just holding on to my body, and I'm guiding my own head and responsible for my own safety. And I grab onto the toilet and put my head in.
Is one of the reasons that you take these photographs to keep the downtime interesting when you're making a movie? There's such long stretches where you're just waiting for the lights or whatever setup you need.
There's an aspect of that, of just entertaining myself. You know, some people will knit sweaters or read books, and I take these photographs, and it's wonderful getting them back, from the lab. You see the proof sheets, and it's like opening up a Christmas present. It's wonderful. There's another aspect to it. I was talking with my mom the other day, and I think she was kind of inspirational to me. She has kept a journal for many, many years. I think it's been going on about 70 years now. And I think that's where I kind of got hooked on this idea of, recording your life. She does it, through the written word, and I'm doing it now through my photography. And it's just personally, when I look through this book, it brings these moments rushing back to me, and it's wonderful to feel that, to have spent such intense times with people that you'll be with them for 10 weeks, and then maybe you won't see them ever again, but you'll have that you'll have a photograph to look at, and it brings all those memories rushing back. And also, you look at, I'm looking through the book, and there's so many returned visits of people that you work with often, for one reason or another, and sometimes I get the feeling it's like different incarnations. Now you're, someone else. It's funny.
Are actors and actresses usually comfortable about you taking their photos on the set when they're not made up or when they're not in costume? Is anyone ever afraid it's going to ruin their image because it's not the kind of made up celebrity face that they're putting forward?
Yeah, I usually make a. Not an announcement, but I ask. It starts with the producer, and then the director, and then the actors. Usually at the first read through of the script, if anyone minds or would like me to take photographs, if they don't want me to do it, I won't do it. And with the actors, particularly, I can, being an actor myself, I understand what their feelings are. Whenever a camera is pointed at you, It's kind of a funny feeling,
Well, especially because there's so many tabloid photographers that are trying to get people when they're off guard and make them look bad, embarrass them.
Yeah, that's right. And I say, when if you just give me a little look, I'll be very sensitive to it and not take a picture. All the photographs in the book were approved by everyone whose, you know, picture was taken, and you know, everyone was kind enough to lend their image to the book. But as far as making them feel uncomfortable, usually throughout the show, I'll start to get film back, and I'll show it to them, and they'll kind of get excited about having some of these memories captured, and they'll you know, they'll be into it.
When you're taking pictures on the set of actors in their off moments, do some of the actors who you're taking pictures of want to stay in character while other actors don't?
Yeah, a few do. A few want to stay in character. I'll find most of them don't, really. You know, most of them kind of, you know, drop it, and then when the cameras are rolling, they, you know, they're well prepared, so they can kick into it. But they, you know, give your body a rest. I find to hold that intense thing can be counterproductive often, for mm-hmm. me anyway.
Mm-hmm. Have you taken photographs of actors who insist on remaining in character even when they're not in front of the camera?
Gee, I don't know. You know, it's kind of hard to separate that idea, this notion of staying in character and mm-hmm. not in character. I remember doing an interview once, and it was when I was playing a sociopath of, I don't know if you saw the movie Jagged Edge.
Right.
But he wasn't a very, very nice fellow. I mean, apparently he was nice, but when you got to know the guy, you found some terrible, despicable things about him. And an interviewer asked me that question, you know, whether you, do you stay in character or not? You know, when you finish working, when you come home, are you in character? And I said, no, not really. And my wife happened to be in the room, and she said, oh, I saw, she rolled her eyes and kind of cleared her throat. And I said, what are you talking about? Why are you giving me that reaction? And she says, you may not know it, but yeah, you carry a lot of that character around. And I think that goes for most actors, and I think it does go for me too, is that you, there's an unconscious preparation that you're not even aware of. And so, you know, a lot of that character is with you all the time and you're not even aware of it. And so these photographs of people, you know, that you take, I'm not really aware if they're in character or not, or how much is them, how much is the character. It's a fuzzy line.
You know, I'm wondering, since you've documented so much of your work through these on the set photographs that you've taken, how were important occasions documented in your family when you were growing up? You know, the birthdays, the holidays, the graduations. Were there a lot of still photographs or home movies?
A lot, you know, there were home movies and still photographs. Not, I don't think any more than you know, normal a family would have. And probably like most families, you know, they stay in the cupboard. You don't look at them too much. For some reason, I don't know why, but I'd like to. You're asking that question. It makes me want to go home and break them all out and look at them all.
If you still have the technology to play them back.
Yeah, there you go. Absolutely, get your beta stuff going.
Because your father was in the movie and television business himself, did he like really direct them?
Actually, now that you mention it, there's one really fond memory comes to mind. This is like maybe about 10 years ago. My family had a place up in Bear Valley, California, where we would all muster up there and have a, you know, a great time together. And one day we're looking for my dad. Nobody can find him, and he's locked into his bedroom, and we're all concerned, and he's saying, don't bother me. And finally, you know, about 4 hours later, he comes out, and he says, please, I want you all to assemble at the table, the dining room table, and we all gather around, and we're expecting him to read a will or something. We don't know what he's going to do. And he says, my young grandson, Dylan, has requested that we film a version of Robin Hood, And so I've taken this time and been in my, locked myself in the room, and I've written a script that we will do. And he proceeded to direct this version of Robin Hood. And we did it all very seriously, and it was so funny how seriously we all approached it. You know, my brother, myself, my wife, and all our kids were all, you know, were all in it. And my dad took it, you know, the most serious of all, and he got in a, I remember, a big fight with my wife because he had all these grandkids out in the snow in peasant wardrobe, you know.
Right.
And my wife was saying, the kids are going to freeze out there. And my dad, you know, blew up and said, oh, I'm trying to make a film, for God's sake. It was just wild. And we have it all on, and my nephew, Casey Bo's son, was the cinema photographer on this epic. And, of course, the best footage is all the behind-the-scenes stuff, which he very smartly filmed as well.
Jeff Bridges speaking with Terry Gross after the publication of his book of photographs, Pictures. We'll hear more of their interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with actor Jeff Bridges. He's currently starring in the new film, The Door in the Floor. He talked with Terry about his collection of photographs.
We started this interview talking about what it looks like on the set, behind the camera. You were on the set when you were a kid because your father, Lloyd Bridges, was making movies and making TV shows and would sometimes bring you along. What did the set look like to you from a child's point of view?
Oh, gosh. The image that I have, and I wish I had a camera back in those days, was going to visit my father on a Western. And I used to love it when he would be in Westerns because he'd always come home and he'd have all the boots and chaps and all that kind of stuff. And I remember dressing up and all that. But in this particular day, I went to visit him on the set, and he was supposed to be on a horse with a bunch of other guys, like a posse or something like that. And of course, the horses were too unruly and would move, so they put all these actors on ladders and with little reins attached to the ladders, you know. And for some reason, that image of these grown men, you know, pretending to be cowboys on these ladders just cracked me up, and they had to remove me from the set. I just couldn't keep it together.
Your father died a few years ago. Do you ever, like, accidentally run into an old movie or a TV show of his? You know, run into an old movie on TV and suddenly, you know, from out of the blue there, you're just kind of seeing him in action?
Oh, yeah. It's so great to have that happen, you know, whenever it does. Especially any films that we did together, because we had such great times, you know. My dad was such an amazing cat, this guy. He loved making movies so much, and unlike a lot of entertainers or you know, motion picture or any kind of actors, I guess, he encouraged all his kids to go into show business. And you know, anytime that there was a part in any of his films or, you know, his TV shows where there was a part, he always, you know, asked if we wanted to be in it. That was great news for us because that meant us getting out of school back in those days. But his enthusiasm for the work was probably the most important thing I learned from him, and this enthusiasm was contagious. You know, whenever he walked on the set, you would just get this idea, you know, this guy loves what he's doing, and hey, we're doing it with him, and this is kind of fun. We're getting off on this thing. This is great. And everyone's level of work would raise a notch whenever he would come around. There's so many different ways to approach the work, and there's some actors who don't like to really relate to the other actors on a personal level. They like to kind of stay in character, you know, and that you can get some great work that way too. But my father's way was a little different. He kind of considered everyone a part of the family, you know. And,
well, you said that's your way too in the book, that you don't relate to people in character when you're on the set. You want to really get to know them, and that you think that might help you also in the filming.
Right, because you can bring those real feelings into the work, you know. Even if you're playing, you know, maybe you really like a person off the camera, but on the, you know, when you're making the movie, you're supposed to be enemies. He's supposed to be your kind of nemesis or whatever. Well, that doesn't really matter, you know. I think, but you know, when you get to know somebody, you can you've got more ammo to work with, you know. If you want to piss him off or tease him, or you know, and then you also have the safety ground that, you know, this person knows that I really care for him, so I can afford to, you know, really tear into it, you know.
In closing, I would like you to describe the picture that's on the cover of your new book.
Ah. Yeah, that is, that's a shot from the Fabulous Baker Boys, one of my favorite movies, largely because it was a movie I did with my brother, Bo. And this is the first day of shooting, and it was in a men's room, so the shot is filled with latrines. And I'm about to, when I put down my camera there, which you can see me holding while I take a picture of Bo, you can see us both in the mirror. I'm about to put that camera down and spray that black fake hair on his head.
Oh.
I don't know if you've seen that movie or not. But it was that scene that we were filming. And in this photograph, the front of the book, you can see my brother and myself in the mirror. And then if you look on the back of the book, you'll see the rest of the crew kind of going about their task, getting ready for the shot. And it's kind of a good example of the format of the camera allows you to really look around in the frame and see all the individual worlds. You know, we all sort of live in our own world in a way, and this camera really brings that out.
Jeff Bridges, thank you so much for talking with us.
Great talking with you, Terry.
Actor Jeff Bridges talking with Terry Gross last fall after the publication of his book of photographs taken on his movie sets. He's currently starring in the new film, The Door in the Floor. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we'll listen back to a vintage interview with science fiction writer Isaac Asimov. The new movie, I, Robot, is loosely based on his work. And some of the earliest Ray Charles recordings. Also, the psychodrama of a heavy metal band. David Edelstein reviews the new documentary, Metallica, Some Kind of Monster.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. When Ray Charles died last month, Ed Ward realized he had a copy of a famous tape of Charles rehearsing with just a piano, his producer, and an engineer back in 1953. It's a beautifully captured memory of a great talent discovering what he can do. And today, we get a guided tour.
My best guess is that it's the spring of 1953. Ray Charles has been with Atlantic Records for around 6 months, and he's gathered with his producer, Ahmet Erdogan, and engineer Tom Dowd to get some material together for his second recording session with them. Now, Atlantic is just one of a lot of struggling young record companies recording rhythm and blues at this point, but it's different. Erdogan and his brother Neshwi are jazz fans, and it's from this angle that they're approaching this young talent they've just signed. The engineer, too, is way more overqualified than he needs to be by the standards of the time. This is a record company that would list the microphones and tape recorders used in their recordings once they started putting out albums. Most rhythm and blues companies would just hire a pickup band and let the singer play onto a tape for 3 hours, but the Atlantic crew is determined to get the highest quality results out of the least amount of time. That's why they've sat down with Ray in the studio, which is actually the Atlantic offices with the desks pushed back against the wall, and had Dowd record the process of him learning the new material. Only then will they call in the band, which will include top-flight musicians like guitarist Mickey Baker and modern jazz quartet drummer Connie Kay, and cut a session. First up is a song called Heartbreaker. Heartbreaker is credited to someone named A. Nugitri, a songwriter so successful that one poor soul at a competing record label once called Atlantic looking to set up a lunch date so that he could steal him away. Asked to spell the name backwards, he saw that it was Erdogan and slunk away. So that's Ahmet Erdogan's voice you hear on this track, feeding Ray the lyrics. Apparently, the list of songs to be recorded hadn't been settled yet, and so Ray spends the next few minutes going through some musical ideas they might be able to use. Finally, he hits on this one.
Man, that's the tune I heard a long time ago.
All right.
I just want another one I thought of. I shouldn't even play it. Please don't be angry with me, baby, because I'm going away. Don't be angry with me, baby, because I'm going away. I try to love you, baby, but you didn't hear a word I say.
After this, he begins playing a country tune, which someone in the room correctly identifies as Little Rock Getaway. I used to play in a hillbilly band, Ray informs him, and plays some more. But clearly, the previous song is still with him, because this is what happens next.
Your ways keep changing, like the shift in desert sand. You see what I mean? Now, you got that part right. See, you only got 6 words there.
Ray, do it again. I'm gonna fight by
it. You know what I mean?
That's
what I mean, and you should have all your verses like that. See, that way I won't have to get off. I gamble on your love, baby. And all I... What's it?
The earlier tune has become Losing Hand, one of his first really great records. They run through it a few more times, with Dowd adding an odd echo effect electronically, and then it's on to the next song, for which Ray's only learned the chorus, so Ahmet helps with the verses.
You know that. I can't stand it.
You cut
it? I'm telling you, it's on my nerves.
As I passed by a real fine hotel, a chick walked out. Sure looks well. I gave her the eye, started to carry on. My Cadillac cruised up and swished. She was gone.
It should have been me.
The mysterious New Guitry, though, has another song, and apparently Ray hasn't heard it yet. So after a try at a song called Nobody, and Ray showing off by blasting through a few bars of bebop, they get down to it. Mess Around would become Ray's first chart hit, reaching number 5 on the R&B charts nearly a year later. At this point, they had 4 of the 5 songs he'd record at the session, and so after Ray ran through Lowell Fulson's Sinner's Prayer and everyone liked it, they must have called it a day. Ray finished out with some nice boogie piano, and whether anyone knew it or not, his career as a star was about to begin.
Ed Ward lives in Berlin.
Up, writing science fiction and coining the term robotics. This is Fresh Air. The new film I, Robot stars Will Smith as a homicide detective seeking a killer among androids.
So why'd you murder him?
I did not murder Dr. Lanning.
Want to explain why you were hiding at the crime scene?
I was frightened.
Robots don't feel fear. They don't feel anything. They don't get hungry. They don't sleep.
I do. I have even had dreams.
Human beings have dreams. Even dogs have dreams, but not you. You are just a machine, an imitation of life. Can a robot write a symphony? Can a robot turn a canvas into a beautiful masterpiece?
Can you?
I think you murdered him because he was teaching you to simulate emotions. Things got out of control.
I did not murder him.
I mean, but emotions don't seem like a very useful simulation for a robot.
I did not murder him.
The hell, I don't want my toaster or my vacuum cleaner appearing emotional.
I did not murder him!
iRobot is loosely based on some 1950s short stories by the legendary science fiction writer Isaac Asimov. When Asimov started writing in the 1930s, he didn't expect that fantasies like space travel and nuclear power would be realities in his lifetime. But through his writing career, he kept looking ahead, projecting what life might be like in the future. Asimov died in 1992, leaving us with over 350 books of science fiction and science fact. He spoke with Terry Gross in 1987 and told her about the first story he got published.
Marooned off Vesta, and I sold it on October 21st, 1938, and it appeared in the stands in the March 1939 issue of Amazing Stories, which hit the stands on January 9th, 1939, 1 week after my 19th birthday.
So what was that first story about?
It was a ship that had gone through the asteroid belt and was hit by an asteroid, and there was just a piece of it left with three men on board, and they had to get themselves down to the asteroid Vesta, which was nearby. And I made it sound as exciting as I could possibly manage. And they bought it. They paid me $64 for it.
Now, what did you base those early stories on? On actual science knowledge that you had or on other science fiction stories that you read?
Mostly on other science fiction stories. Although they got me interested in science, and I gradually learned science as a result. But science fiction was an even earlier influence.
Now, you coined the term robotics in a story that I think you wrote in 1942.
That's right. The story was called Runaround. And I had someone refer to the three laws of robotics, and that was the... In fact, I think they called them three rules the first time I mentioned them. But that was the first time the word robotics was ever used in print in the English language. And I get the credit for it in the Oxford English Dictionary.
Would you review the three rules of robotics that you came up with?
Well, I eventually called them three laws. Number one is a robot may not harm a human being or through inaction allow a human being to come to harm. Second law is a robot must obey orders given it by a human being, except where that would conflict with the first law. And the third is a robot must protect its own existence, except where that would conflict with the first or second laws.
Now, these were rules for robot designers?
That's right. And as a matter of fact, they're taken seriously. In other words, a great many of the early people who worked in robotics were more or less inspired by my robot stories, and they knew the three laws, and they realized that if they could develop robots that obeyed them, that would be great. So far, the robots we have are still extremely simple computerized levers. They're not complex enough to have the three laws built into them.
What were the robots that you envisioned in the 1940s when you were writing this story?
Well, they were typical robots that we used in science fiction. They were made of metal, and they had a roughly humanoid shape. My contribution was that they were designed with safeguards. That's what the three laws were. Until my robots came in, mostly what robot stories consisted of was robots being built and then destroying their creators. It was the Frankenstein story told over and over and over and over again. And I took the attitude that robots would be machines and that one of the chief concerns of those who built them was to make it impossible for them to do harm. That apparently struck everyone as sensible because after my stories became popular, the old-fashioned robot stories disappeared. And the new kinds of robot stories, even when they didn't quote my laws, which, of course, they didn't like to because they were mine, they simply assumed they existed, and so did the readers.
You know, for years you've really been writing more science than you have science fiction. How come?
Oh, well, until 1958, I wrote mostly science fiction. But then when Sputnik went up and everyone in the United States got scared that we were falling behind in science, I felt it was absolutely necessary for anyone who knew science and could write to try his hand at educating the American public. So I deliberately stopped writing science fiction, mostly, and started writing science books. And that went on for 21 years, and then Doubleday got tired. And they said they wanted me to go back to writing science fiction novels. And they were very persuasive. And so I wrote Foundation's Edge, which was a continuation of the old Foundation series that I'd written 30 years earlier. And it hit the bestseller list, stayed on for 25 weeks. To my intense surprise, it was my 262nd book. And until then, I thought I had a perfect score, you know, that I knew exactly how to miss the bestseller list. I'd done it 261 times in a row, and flopping on the 262nd surprised me. But after that, Doubleday wouldn't be stopped. They wanted a novel every year, and I've been writing them, and they've been doing very, very well, I'm glad to say, because they're hard to do.
Had you lost your interest in science fiction during that hiatus?
No, not at all. But I had thought that the field had gotten beyond me. You know, it's a rapidly developing field, and the science fiction that's written today isn't at all like the science fiction I wrote in my time. And I felt that I was just a quaint hangover from a previous generation and that it would show. And I didn't make any effort to write in the 80s fashion, let us say. They wanted another Foundation book. I wrote it exactly as I wrote my Foundation books in the 1940s. And it seemed to go well. So I continued writing in my way, regardless of any changes that had taken place. And there seemed to be enough people who are willing to read my stuff, written in its way, for it to be reasonably successful. So I'm happy.
I think it's fair to say that you've been pretty obsessed with the brain over the years. You've written a lot of science books and science essays about the brain, and I think, is it fair to say that that's the organ of the body that interests you most?
Well, in a way, yes. In the first place, that's the way I make my living. I mean, I use my brain such as it is. And in the second place, it is at once the most hopeful and the most dangerous part of the human body. And most hopeful because solutions to problems arise from the human brain. And the most dangerous because the problems themselves also arise from the human brain. It's the thoughts, the ideas, the genius that solve the problems, but it's our tendency towards hatreds and fears and suspicions that create the problems. And we don't know how the brain works. So that naturally makes it all the more interesting.
You know, your book, Fantastic Voyage, reminded me in a way of an essay that you wrote a few years ago about a triple heart bypass that you had. And in that essay, you described having an angiogram, which is where they basically inject dye into an artery so that they could monitor the flow of blood through the heart. And you had the option of watching the angiogram on the video screen that your heart was being monitored on, but you wrote that you turned your head and you didn't want to watch it.
No, I didn't.
For the author of Fantastic Voyage, describing all these scientists journeying through the body's bloodstream, I thought that was pretty interesting.
Well, I hadn't thought of that, but, you know, it's like that old statement saying that the management is not responsible for the views expressed in this program. Well, I'm the management, and I'm not responsible for the views presented in my in my stories. I travel all over the galaxy. In real life, I hate to travel, and I never go in airplanes. When I wrote a book called The Human Body, I described every conceivable disease and bad working that I could think of without a shudder. But in real life, I'm very queasy.
Well, now we could get to your fear of planes. For someone who wrote about a spacewalk before astronauts actually landed on the moon, yet you were afraid to fly planes. That's quite a paradox.
Well, I'm not sure that I'm afraid to fly them. I just
don't trust
never
them.
Got into the habit of it, that's all. And now it's too late. I just don't want to. But that's part of a bigger problem. I just hate to travel by any means. I like to stay where I am. I never leave Manhattan voluntarily. And I don't know why that is. When I'm forced to travel, it doesn't bother me very much. It's just that I happen to like it at home.
You once wrote that we should not see science or technology as inevitable destroyers or saviors. Does that kind of sum up your view of technology?
That's right. It's technology is neutral. That is, it depends on how it's used. It's up to us to use it wisely or foolishly. And often our intentness on immediate gain, on short-term goals, causes us to use it foolishly without due regard for the long-term harm we might do. And that's sad, of course, but on the other hand, it's understandable. It's very difficult for human beings to take the long view and to give up the immediate profit.
Isaac Asimov, speaking with Terry Gross, recorded in 1987. He died in 1992. Coming up, the new documentary on the heavy metal band Metallica. This is Fresh Air. The documentary film Metallica, Some Kind of Monster, chronicles 2 years in the life of the heavy metal band. Metallica has sold 90 million albums since 1981, but 3 years ago the group was torn by personal and creative differences. The band's solution was to hire a therapist, and they let two filmmakers listen in. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
It might sound like an insult to say the new documentary Metallica, Some Kind of Monster, is like a nonfiction remake of This Is Spinal Tap. But that landmark mockumentary had a real subject. It was about heavy metal legends fighting to maintain their status as rock gods in the face of middle age, petty jealousy, the toll of reckless hedonism, and of course, idiocy. Some Kind of Monster isn't a joke, but it has the same tension as Spinal Tap between the ferocious energy it takes to keep a monster metal group aloft and the weight of the real world, which finally drives the members of Metallica into group therapy and beyond. Now, why would the group open itself up to having this documented? It helped that they had a relationship with the filmmakers, Joe Berlinger and Bruce Sinofsky. They donated songs to Paradise Lost, a devastating documentary about Memphis teenagers convicted of the murder of three little boys. And the Metallica documentary was intended as a relatively straightforward look at the making of an album, the first in years for a group that sold nearly 100 million records. But as the process begins in the movie, that old black magic isn't there. The longtime bassist has decamped, and there's something eating at the singer, James Hetfield, who's quarreling with the drummer and co-founder, Lars Ulrich. The band engages a therapist to help them talk through their problems. But Hetfield still can't rise to the occasion, can't manufacture the adrenaline or endorphins or whatever it takes to make great music.
I don't know, I guess the playing part, being in the room, and then mainly being in the room with Lars, playing music together, I guess I had higher expectations, and I don't know, maybe I'm disappointed in myself. Maybe, I don't know.
Want to talk about that? I mean, what does that mean?
I'm not enjoying being in the room with you playing.
Let it be known to you that I'm certainly not having a lot of fun either. But I am not interested in playing music with you if you're not happy in there. I just don't want to become a parody, okay? So if you're not happy playing music with me.
After that, there's a nasty exchange about Hetfield's guitar playing, which Ulrich calls stock. I'd have played that scene, but every other word would be bleeped. Hetfield angrily takes off, and the next anyone hears, he's in rehab for like 9 months. And so Metallica faces its own mortality. We see Ulrich twisting in limbo, having just alienated masses of fans with a lawsuit against Napster, now the face of a greedy rock star and stewing in his own impotence. a scene with his Danish dad, a former tennis star, and an amazing figure with a white beard out of Lord of the Rings, is an eye-opener. The patriarch is a stern judge, with no patience for people who settle for stock guitar playing or anything status quo. You can see where Ulrich gets his critical impatience, and maybe why he pushed the boundaries and commissioned a documentary like this one. Berlinger and Sadovsky make themselves part of the story when Hetfield comes back. And that transparency throws the question back at the viewer. Will Hetfield be strong enough to survive our scrutiny now that he's so undefended? It's quite a contrast, this quiet, clean, and sober man, his image intercut with shots of his prime as a Dionysian, long-haired, boozy metal titan. Suddenly, his life is structured, his Metallica participation limited to 4 hours a day, and we watch his partner Ulrich chafe against these restraints. At some point, all successful rock bands confront what Max Weber called the bureaucratization of charismatic leadership. But isn't that bureaucracy what metal generally rails against? And what to do about that touchy-feely therapist? Must they shed him to regain their potency and swagger on stage as metal men? Hetfield raises the ultimate question in a climactic performance before inmates at San Quentin. Can you have aggression, the kind of head-banging fury that gave birth to heavy metal, without negative energy? Metallica, some kind of monster, is loose and uninsistent, yet the underpinnings keep it riveting. It's about a youth culture that makes all aging graceless, a therapeutic culture that makes all aggression suspect, and a capitalist culture that makes the potential collapse of a zillion-dollar enterprise like Metallica the stuff of high drama. You might think that Metallica is just chunky, non-melodic noise. I do, although I like a few songs better now that I know from whence they came. But the band's implosion and reassembly makes for one of the most marvelous rock documentaries of all time.
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate.
These are the eyes that can't see me. These are the hands that drop your trust. These are the boots that kick you around. This is the tongue that speaks on the inside. These are the ears that ring with hate. This is the face that never change. This is the fist that grinds you down. This is the voice of silence no more.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer this week is Roberta Shorrock. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Dial Press, publisher of The Rule of Four, a debut suspense novel of the puzzling connection between an ancient manuscript and an Ivy League murder by Ian Caldwell and Dustin Thomason. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, The Word from Rome. We'll talk with John Allen, who writes about the Vatican for the National Catholic Reporter. He'll update us on controversies involving the Vatican's influence on politics and the abuse scandal. Join us for the next Fresh Air.